Nothing obsessed explorers of the mid-19th century more than the quest to discover the source of the White Nile. It was the planet's most elusive secret, the prize coveted above all others. Between 1856 and 1876, six larger-than-life men and one extraordinary woman accepted the challenge. Showing extreme courage and resilience, Richard Burton, John Hanning Speke, James Augustus Grant, Samuel Baker, Florence von Sass, David Livingston and Henry Morton Stanley risked their lives and reputations in the fierce competition. We're now in Tim Giel's story of the explorers of the Nile. With Burton too ill to travel, Speke goes it alone. The reader is Alex Jennings.
By the 29th of July, 1858, after nearly 3 weeks of travelling through a waterless wilderness of thorn and forest, John Hanning Speke was crossing hilly country with well-cultivated valleys dotted with palms. The very next day, Speke saw a sheet of water several miles away that turned out to be a creek of the Great Nyanza. Like Nyasa, the word Nyanza denoted a large body of water. His eyes were still too sensitive for him to travel without wearing his French grey spectacles, which so excited the crowd who followed the caravan. 2 days later, with spectacles on his nose, Speke climbed a low hill and from its summit was overjoyed to see the pale blue waters of the Nyanza. He was entranced with its sandy beaches and wooded slopes. The islands, each swelling in a gentle slope to a rounded summit, mirrored in the calm surface of the lake. To stand here as the white discoverer of the mysterious Nyanza, later to be named Lake Victoria, which was entirely unknown in Europe and America, made this the most joyful moment of his life to date. Burton was genuinely relieved to see Speke return to Kaze in the early hours of the 25th of August, because he had heard reports of fighting near the lake. Towards the end of breakfast, Speke announced that he had found the source of the Nile. Burton promptly dismissed all this as foolish speculation. He now not only turned down Speke's proposal to revisit the lake with him, but refused even to consider the possibility of sailing north across the lake to Uganda to find out whether the Kivira River flowed out of the north side of the Nyanza and became the Nile. With Burton being carried by six long-suffering porters, they finally reached Zanzibar on the 4th of March, 1859, on the way back to England. Burton was not granted a medical certificate to travel home, whereas Speke was. And now Burton claimed that crucial words were spoken in which Speke promised not to upstage his commander before Burton arrived home.
"The last words Jack ever spoke to me on earth were, 'Goodbye, old fellow. You may be quite sure I shall not go up to the Royal Geographical Society until we appear together.'"
But the phrase, "the last words Jack ever spoke," showed that this must have been written by Burton not at the time, but after Speke's death in 1864. Speke wrote his own account, in which he mentions that just before his ship sailed, "Captain Burton said he would not go to England for many months, as he intended to go to Jerusalem." Then Speke adds, "A fortnight after my landing in England, Captain Burton unexpectedly arrived." On the 9th of May, 1859, the day after Speke landed in England, he was summoned to the RGS to meet the President, Sir Roderick Murchison. Speke showed him his map of the Nyanza and told him that the Kivira River to the north end of Lake Victoria fed the Nile. "Sir Roderick, I need only say, at once accepted my views," wrote Speke. Burton arrived at Southampton Docks on the 20th of May, far earlier than Speke had expected. Burton complained that on arrival he found that everything had been done for, or rather against me. "My companion," said Burton, "stood forth in his true colours as an angry rival." He never forgave Speke for his success and would eventually claim the expedition's entire achievement as his alone. "I led the most disorderly of caravans into the heart of intertropical Africa and succeeded in discovering the Tanganyika and the southern portion of what is now called the Victoria Nyanza Lake." By April 1860, the committee of the RGS endorsed Speke's proposal that he return to the Nyanza and then march along the lake's western shore to Uganda and the Kivira River. Speke's fellow explorer was Captain James Grant, an Indian Army officer who had fought with Speke in the Punjab. They started from Bagamoyo on the east coast of Africa on the 2nd of October 1860 with a caravan of 200, including 65 Wangwana, the black Swahili-speaking free people of Zanzibar. They were soon experiencing the usual frustrations and hardships of African travel. The rains swept in, worse than an Indian monsoon, and soon desertions increased dangerously. The expedition's numbers had almost halved by early December, and the following March the caravan reached a village called Ukumbi. Here the villagers flew about brandishing their spears and pulling their bows in the most grotesque attitudes, alarming some of my porters so much that they threw down their loads and bolted. Just north of Kaze, three quarters of the way to the lakes, Speke's shortage of porters obliged him to spend 2.5 months trying to recruit. Yet giving up never entered his mind. By the end of November they had reached a country of grassy hills, and from the top of one they saw far below them a beautiful lake, which Speke and Grant thought very like England's Lake Windermere. On a plateau overlooking the water was a palace enclosure shielded by a screen of trees. To their surprise, the king, Rumanika, invited them in at once. Speke and Grant celebrated Christmas at Rumanika's court with his athletic sons and amazingly fat daughters, who were force-fed with milk and beef juice until they became almost spherical. These princesses were showing that they had parents who could afford to feed them prodigiously. Speke persuaded one young woman, who was unable to stand except on all fours, to allow him to measure her. The circumference of her upper arm was an amazing 2 feet, and that of her thigh almost 3 feet. On the 7th of January 1862, an Indian ivory trader arrived with news that Mutesa, the king of Buganda, was sending officers to escort Speke and Grant to his kingdom, the next stage on their journey. As the first of his race ever to be seen by the king and his courtiers, Speke gave much thought to the figure he ought to cut when marching to the royal palace, where his audience was scheduled to take place. He was gripped by the drama of arriving at a unique feudal court, so the Union flag was carried in front of him by his kirangozi, while just behind him, a 12-man guard of honour dressed in red flannel cloaks followed. The rest of his people came next, each carrying a present. Before Speke could mention his plans for exploration, the king asked whether he would show him some of his guns. Mutesa appeared quite confused with the various wonders as he handled them, and sat poring over his presents until the light began to fail. The 4 rich silk cloths, 10 bundles of rare beads, and several sets of cutlery received less attention. 3 days later, the king summoned Speke and asked him to shoot the 4 cows that were walking about the court. Speke borrowed the revolver he had given to the Kabaka and succeeded in killing all 4 with 5 rapidly fired shots. But what followed showed Mutesa in a darker light. The king loaded one of the carbines Speke had given him, and handing it full cock to a page, told him to go out and shoot a man in the outer court. The boy obeyed. A horrified Speke observed in his journal, "There appeared no curiosity to know what individual human being the urchin had deprived of life." Speke soon realized that he was getting nowhere with his plans to gain the king's permission to travel eastwards along the northern shores of Lake Victoria to the Kivira River. So having heard that the king's mother suffered from various medical complaints, he decided to enlist her support. The Queen Mother told him that her liver was sending shooting pains all over her body. Speke examined her and prescribed 2 quinine pills and told her to drink less pombe, the local beer. The Queen Mother immediately produced 2 very young Wahuma girls for him to take back to his hut, or that's what Speke said in his book. But in his original manuscript, Mary, the elder, is clearly described as being 18 years or so. And now, to his amazement, Speke found himself in love. But to his grief, this was not how Mary, whom he described as my beautiful Venus, saw him. Quite often she refused to speak to him, or go for walks, or do anything, but lie at full length all day long, lounging in the most indolent manner. By the end of the month he wrote, "Mary showed neither love nor attachment for me, and my offers were indifferently accepted without grace, which broke my sleep and destroyed my rest. I therefore dismissed her. I then rushed out of the house with an overflowing heart and walked hurriedly about till after dark." A week later, Mary asked with tears in her eyes to be taken back. Sadly, what she told him next convinced the romantic Speke that the situation was hopeless. She wished to return so that she might die in the favours of a rich man. At last, after 4.5 months, the king agreed to let him travel to the northeastern corner of Lake Victoria. The 50-mile journey proved trouble-free, and on the 21st of July, Speke wrote joyfully in his journal, "Here, at last, I stood on the brink of the Nile. Most beautiful was the scene. Nothing could surpass it." The valley was shaded here and there by tall trees, and the soft grass reminded him of English parkland. In November, he and Grant left Bunyoro and began their journey downstream in a large dugout on the Carfu River, which joined the main stream after a few miles. En route for home, at the British consulate in Khartoum, Speke wrote out a telegram for the RGS. "Inform Sir Roderick Murchison that all is well, and that the Nile is settled." At Cairo, Speke arranged for his 19 Wangwana faithfuls to be photographed. He also paid them 3 years' wages and made a down payment on a vegetable garden for their use in Zanzibar. Speke and Grant sailed for home in February 1863. The two explorers expected applause from the public and got it, but there now followed criticism of Speke's claims from armchair geographers, who pointed out that he had not followed the whole course of the river and established a foolproof link between Lake Victoria and the known Nile. When Burton came home on leave from an obscure diplomatic posting a year later, the apparently glittering prospects of his famous former sub, compared to his own declining fortunes, made him seethe with jealousy. The RGS arranged a discussion between Speke and Burton on the source of the Nile, scheduled for the 16th of August in Bath. The day before the event, John Hanning Speke died accidentally while out shooting partridges. The unanimous verdict of the coroner's jury was that the deceased died from the accidental discharge of his own gun. This would not stop Richard Burton saying that the explorer had committed suicide to avoid the exposure of his misstatements in regard to the Nile sources. Speke was 37 years old when he died, and the Times, in its obituary, accepted that on balance it was likely that he had found the source of the Nile. But both Burton and David Livingstone disagreed. The dead man's reputation seemed doomed to sink into a kind of limbo.
In tomorrow's instalment, picking up where John Speke left off, Samuel Baker and his mistress Florence go in search of Lake Albert. Explorers of the Nile by Tim Jill was read by Alex Jennings, abridged by Libby Spurrier, and produced by Joanna Green. It was a peer production for BBC Radio.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, I'm Jim Lee. It's 3 o'clock and the Saint is back in action in another 60-minute adventure now. Then in the 4 o'clock show, Mel Gedroych hears about the pleasures of a moonlight bike ride, finds out where comedian Lee Evans gets his gags, and meets a lady who knits with 4-metre-long needles. And looking ahead to this evening at 8:30, the supermodel Erin O'Connor opens the door to the dynamic and controversial world of fashion. But first to the second of this week's hour-long adventures with The Saint, alias Simon Templar, the creation of Leslie Charteris. This plot has two titles. It's also known as The Last Hero, and it begins with the game of passing the pineapples on the rooftops. Paul Rees stars in The Saint closes the case.
So, good. 3.4 seconds to the lamppost. Finishing post. Then boom. 3 booms. And frantic bourgeois insects down there everywhere.
Should be an interesting spectacle.
Police?
No. Sad for you, innit?
Can't imagine why you might be expecting His Majesty's Constabulary. Now, don't be willful, there's a good boy. Oris has never missed at this range.
So who are you?
There are those who call me the Saint.
And what do you want with me?
You are Mr. Golter of the Black Wolves, and I claim my £5. That's the form, isn't it?
I do not know the man.
Oh, do us a favour, will
you? Oris, you assured me. I shall stop £2.10 from your wages. But bad luck for you, beautiful. Looking so like a murderous anarchist.
As you say.
Innocently propping up a chimney stack, which just by happy chance overlooks Crown Prince Rudolf's progress to his Guildhall luncheon.
It might seem.
Well, I'll tell you what, sweetness. You pass your pineapples to me, one by one, eh? And leave the pins in.
And look sharp about it. First one up, come on.
Now you see it, now you don't.
And the others.
Now you do again. Catch!
Oh.
Never makes a cricketer your anarchist, does he? Something to do with fair play.
You must be mad.
What you whining about? Ain't the pin still in?
Take your Uncle Simon's advice, Golter, old man. Don't go dropping Mills bombs about. They're liable to go off bang, you see. So, put them back in your pocket. That's a good boy.
Why this foolish conjuring game?
Reasons of my own. You aren't impressed?
5 minutes, sir.
So, we must be leaving you, Golter. Do you mind it terribly?
You are a madman.
Is that why you're afraid?
I do not fear you.
But you ought to, beautiful. You really ought. Still, your royal procession will be here in a few minutes, though we shan't be able to watch it. Pity. From a purely artistic point of view, you understand.
I have work to do.
Of course. For the likes of you, Golter, there can never be any excuse, can there?